I'm pretty sure I've told you before about this weird compulsion that I have. One of probably multiple. Anyway, I'm just going to talk about one of them today. When I'm driving my truck around town and that little light comes on that's right next to the fuel gauge that says you're almost out of gas. When that light comes on, I take it as a personal challenge to get every drop out of that gas tank before I fill the truck up without running out of gas. And I know that, I know that once that light comes on, I have about 40 to 50 miles that I can get out of it before it runs out of gas. And so I will run it down, and as soon as that light comes on, I begin tracking my miles. Because just before it runs out of gas, I then switch cars with Diane and leave her with the truck. It's led to many happy moments in our marriage. Yes. I don't know at what point in my toilet training caused this arrested development. Maybe a psychologist can help me with that. But I have a feeling I'm not the only person who does that. Get some enjoyment out of running that tank down to empty. But I bring that up because it's not just cars and trucks that have fuel tanks. People have fuel tanks too. Except it's not full of fuel. It's our spirit. All of us have a spirit inside of us. And at different times, our spirit can be full or it can be depleted. And sometimes it gets all the way down to empty and there's a red light that comes on to let us know that we've run it down too far. We've run it down too far. But when our spirit is full, when the tank of our spirit is full, when our inner being is filled up, we're full of things like hope, courage, joy, strong will, clear vision. And when our tank is depleted, there's not much hope, there's not much courage, there's not much conviction, there's not much of a will. Our vision's not clear, we're really not sure where we're headed. And just statistics say that in this room, there's some of us who have a very full tank today, full of life, full of energy, full of conviction. And some of us are not. And some of us whose tank is kind of dry are very annoyed by those whose tank is very full because we want what they have. I'll tell you, my tank's a little on the dry side today. It's not your fault, but this happens. Our tanks fill up and then they get depleted. Now, we don't have a gauge like the one on the car or the truck that tells us exactly where we are, but there are ways to gauge approximately how full our inner tank is. One way to gauge a person's tank is just by looking in their eyes. You know, if you look in a person's eyes, they say that the eyes are the window to the soul. If you look into a person's eyes and they're alive and it's like they're dancing, you know their tank is full. You know, their inner being is filled up. But if you look in a person's eyes and they look kind of glazed over, lacking in life, you know their tank is empty. You can also gauge a person's spiritual tank just by the way they carry themselves. If someone walks in such a way that they're kind of bowed, their shoulders are slouched, they're kind of hunched over, maybe they're moving slowly, it's a sign their tank is empty. But a person whose tank is full, they hold their head high, their shoulders are square, you know, and they're not trudging, they're marching when they move. And one of the things that has a profound impact on our spiritual tank, our spiritual resources, are the people around us. I don't have to tell you this, but some people, just by being in their presence, by being connected to them, you come away feeling drained and depleted. Why? You know something about that, Zahir? No, I mean, seriously, you come away and you feel like you have less joy, you have less energy, you have less hope, less courage, less enthusiasm, and you're not exactly anxious to go back there again because you feel like something gets pulled out of your spirit. And conversely, some people, when you're with them, just being in their presence, connecting with them, fills up your tank. Hallelujah. You come away renewed with more energy, more hope, more enthusiasm. And you say, you know, I was kind of anxious before I was with this person, but my anxiety's less. Or, you know, I was kind of fearful about what's coming up, what the next thing on my agenda, but I have hope now. I have faith. And I like being with that person. In the early 4th century, so we're going back 1,600 years, one of the church fathers, one of the leaders of the Christian church, was a guy by the name of Gregory of Nyssa. Now, Gregory of Nyssa liked to go to the track, liked to go to the horse races. And he wrote a letter to one of his friends, and he used the horse racing, the track, as a metaphor in this letter. He says to his friend, he says, at the horse races, the spectators who are intent on victory shout to their favorite horse in the contest. From the balcony, they incite the rider to keener effort, urging the horses on while leaning forward and flailing the air with their outstretched hand instead of a whip. They're cheering on their favorite horse, the one that they've bet on. And then Gregory of Nyssa, in the same letter, he goes on to say to his friend, he says, "And I seem to be doing the same thing myself, most valued friend and brother. While you are competing admirably in the divine race, straining constantly for the prize of the heavenly calling, I exhort you, I urge you, and I encourage you vigorously." In other words, Gregory of Nyssa is basically saying to his friend, he says, "Friend, brother, you're in a race. You're in the race of your life. It's a divine race. It's a divine calling that you're in. And I want you to know that as you are in this divine race, this divine calling, I'm up in the balcony, I'm up in the grandstands, and I'm cheering you on. I'm urging you to victory. I'm here behind you. I'm supporting you. I'm your balcony guy. I'm the one up there in the grandstands cheering you on. So don't get discouraged. Keep running the race." Now, there are some people who do that for you, right? They're your grandstand person. They cheer you on, they encourage you, they motivate you. And when you are with them, they fill up your tank. You come away encouraged. And then you have other people in your life who, instead of filling up your tank, they drain your tank. And more often than not, it comes through complaining and being critical, basically by being impossible to please. Just to make this really clear, I want to give you two examples of how this works. The first one is an old story about a guy. He's a hunter, and he has a friend who drains his tank, just pulls out all his energy. And he tells his friend about the wonderful things in his life, and his friend's never impressed. Never excited for him. And so one day, this guy gets a brand new hunting dog. So it's an awesome dog. It's incredibly well-trained. It can scent things. In other words, it has an incredible sense of smell. It can smell things that are a mile away. And it can point, you know, it can point for an hour without even moving. Just an awesome hunting dog. And so this guy takes his friend home so that he can show him this wonderful hunting dog. And of course, when he shows his friend this dog, the friend's not impressed. Big deal. Well, the climactic moment comes when the guy shoots a duck, and the duck falls into a pond and lands in the water, and it floats there on top of the water. And so this guy sends his awesome hunting dog out to get the duck that's on top of the pond. And when the dog gets to the edge of the pond, instead of jumping in and swimming to the duck, the dog actually walks on the water out to the duck. And he gets the duck, and he walks on water and brings it back to the guy. And so this guy, he knows that his friend has to be impressed now. So he turns to his friend thinking, at least finally my friend is going to say, wow, that's impressive. Instead, he turns to the friend, and the friend says, your dog can't swim, can he? Hey, there are people like that, no? They cannot be impressed. Let me give you another example. There's this guy who has a barber. And every time he goes to the barber to get his hair cut, he tells the barber about his life, about his family, about everything that's going on in his life. And again, the barber is one of these guys who's never impressed. Never gets excited about anything that this guy tells him. And so the day comes when the guy's getting ready to go on a vacation. He's going to Italy. And he's going to have an audience with the Pope while he's in Italy, while he's in Rome. Now, this guy knows that his barber is Catholic. And so he's sure that telling him, I'm going to see the Pope in Rome, is going to make his Catholic barber impressed. Wow, you're going to see the Pope. So he tells the barber this exciting news, he's going to see the Pope in Rome. And the barber says, big deal. You're going to see the Pope, but you'll never get close to him. You'll be far away. Big deal. So the guy goes to Italy for his vacation, and he comes back from vacation, and he goes to get his haircut with his barber. And he says to the barber, you will never believe what happened to me when I was in Rome, because I not only saw the Pope, I got to meet the Pope. And the barber says, you did not. Get out of here. The guy says, yeah, I did. I was in this receiving line, and I actually got to go right up to the Pope and have a one-on-one conversation with him. I got to shake his hand. I knelt down in front of him in his chair. I took his hand. I kissed his ring. I bowed my head before the Pope. And would you believe the Pope spoke to me? Well, the barber couldn't help but be impressed. Wow, the Pope spoke to you? What did the Pope say to you? He asked me, where did you get that lousy haircut? So, all right, now you have an idea of the kind of person we're talking about. And we all have someone, and maybe multiple people in our life, who can rob us of whatever our good experiences are, rob us of joy, rob us of hope, rob us of faith. We all have someone who is fault-finding, joy-impaired, impossible to please or impress. And the truth is, this is the truth, we all have the potential to be that guy or to be that person. We all do. We all have within us the capacity to be hypercritical and joyless. And we get to choose who's going to run the show. And I'll just put it out there, way too many times I've been that guy to the people around me. I'm the one who is the sponge, the joy robber, the hope robber, the enthusiasm robber, and people come away from me feeling, wow, my tank was more full than when I hung out with Dennis. So we can all be that person. But here's the point. That's not the person that God designed us to be. That's not who he had in mind. And so that's why in Hebrews 10:25, the verse that we heard this morning, it says, "Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching." Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another. Now, this text is frequently used to encourage people to go to church. And it's an appropriate use of the text. It says, let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. Let us not give up fellowship. It's important. However, this text is not just about church attendance. It's about the importance of Christian fellowship in general. Because what is the purpose of Christian fellowship? The text says it's to encourage each other. We need to be surrounded by people who will encourage each other and therefore build up our reserve, build up our inner tank. Because every single person here, every single one of you is running the race of your life. And the race is energy depleting. It's draining. And if you're going to run the race well, if you're going to finish the race well, you need people in your life who are sitting in your own balcony, in your own grandstand, cheering you on, encouraging you to victory. And that, as a Christian community, is what we are to be for each other. Encouragers, uplifters, balcony people for each other. Now, in the New Testament, what we might call the patron saint of encouragement is a guy by the name of Barnabas. And we first hear about Barnabas in the book of Acts chapter 4, where it tells us, Acts chapter 4, let's see, 4 verse 36. It says, "Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold a field that he owned and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet." This is the first time we hear about Barnabas. Now, his given name was not Barnabas. His given name was Joseph. But they called him Barnabas because it means son of encouragement. In other words, Barnabas was God's grandstand guy. He was someone who would encourage other people, cheer them on to victory in their own race. And in the next few minutes, I just want to show you two snippets from the life of Barnabas that show why the disciples called him Barnabas, even though his name was actually Joseph, why they called him the son of encouragement, and show us what it means to be a grandstand kind of person for those around us. First snippet from the life of Barnabas comes from Acts chapter 9. Now, there is a man by the name of Saul who is literally terrorizing the early Christian church. In fact, it says in Acts 9, verse 1, speaking of this guy, Saul, it says, "Meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there, any Christians there, who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem." Okay, Saul was absolutely zealous for his faith. And so he was out looking for Christians. At that time, they didn't call them Christians. They called them followers of the way. So that he could persecute them, put them in prison. So Saul was well known to every single Christian at that time. Every one of them knew his name, and every Christian was afraid of Saul. And then, as Saul is heading to Damascus, he has this incredible conversion experience, this amazing story, where he's thrown to the ground, and he has an audible person-to-person interaction with none other than Jesus himself. And he comes away a different person. Saul repents. He trusts in Jesus, and he goes from being a persecutor of people of the way to being a follower of the way. Literally in a moment, he goes from being persecutor to participant. Now, immediately Saul, after his conversion experience, Saul, who would later become Paul, immediately Saul is faced with a problem. Because he's now part of the group that he's been trying to persecute. So he goes to Jerusalem, the headquarters of the Christian church, and he tries to join the disciples there. But of course they're afraid of him, because they all know he doesn't like them and he's out to get them. So none of the Christians in Jerusalem believe that this guy's sincere. They think he's really now just trying to infiltrate and get on the inside and be a mole. So nobody wants anything at all. None of the Christians want anything to do with Saul. In fact, they treat him like he has leprosy. They just completely stay away from him. It's kind of like that old commercial for Life cereal, you know, where the mom gives a bowl of this cereal to these two brothers. And the one says, "I don't want to eat it. You eat it." And the other brother says, "Well, I don't want to try it either. I don't like it." And so, and then in unison, they both say, "Let's give it to Mikey. He'll eat anything." You remember that old commercial? Well, it's kind of like that here. You have one Christian who says, "I don't want to touch Saul. He's dangerous. I don't trust him." And another Christian says, "I don't want to trust him. I don't want anything to do with this guy." And they both say, "Hey, let's give him to Barney. He'll touch anybody." And so that's what they do. They hand Paul over to Barnabas and say, "Barnabas, you figure out what to do with this guy, because we don't want anything to do with him." And so they hand Barnabas over to check. They hand Saul over to Barnabas to check him out. And Barnabas is willing to take a risk on Saul. He takes a risk because he becomes Saul's friend. He befriends him. He trusts him. And after a period of time, he says, "You know, this guy's legit." So he goes back to the other Christians, the other disciples, and he says, "Guys, I need you to know this Saul guy is the real deal. He really has been converted. He really is one of us now. He's not out to get us. He really has devoted his life to the gospel. You really can trust this guy." And we're told that because of this, the other disciples actually embraced Saul. It says in Acts 9:28, it says, "So Saul stayed with them and moved about freely in Jerusalem, speaking boldly in the name of the Lord." Okay, so Paul became part of the way. Now, what would have happened to Saul, who later became Paul, what would have happened if there had been no Barnabas? I mean, Paul turned out to be the great leader of the early Christian church. What if there was no Barnabas? Saul was accepted in the Christian community specifically because of Barnabas. He was God's grandstand guy. He had this inclination to trust Saul. He didn't let Saul's past limit him. He was willing to take a chance on him. And so through Barnabas, Saul had the wonderful gift of getting to start over. And see, all of us need a Barnabas in our life. Someone who can see the best in us. Someone who sees the potential in us. Someone who believes in that. Calls that out in us. And sometimes we need to be a Barnabas to the people around us, to see the potential, the capability, the ability to be better than you were in your past. We need that, and we need to be that at times for each other. Now, because Barnabas was a leader in the early Christian church, Barnabas went on a lot of mission trips. And so early on, when Barnabas would go on a mission trip, he invited Paul now to go with him. And so when they would travel, they traveled together for an entire year. They would go as a team, and they had a dramatic impact on a large number of people. But they always went this way. Barnabas was the leader. Paul was the helper. Barnabas was number one. Paul was number two. Now, in the ancient world, you can always tell the status in a group by whose name is listed first, the order that, names appear. The top person is listed first, second in command comes after that, and so on. So the order of a list of names is always telling of the hierarchy. Now, in the book of Acts, we actually see this dynamic at work, where it lists names and it's telling of what the hierarchy is. For example, in Acts 11, Acts 11:29, speaking of Paul and Barnabas, it says, "The disciples, each according to his ability, decided to provide help for the brothers living in Judea. This they did, sending their gift to the elders by Barnabas and Saul." Barnabas is listed first, Saul is listed second. Barnabas is lead, Saul is the companion. Go over two chapters to Acts 13, verse 20, and we see this dynamic again. It says, Acts 13, verse 2, it says, "While they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, 'Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work which I have called them.'" Again, Barnabas listed first, Saul listed second. Now, over time, Saul, who became Paul, began to mature, and his gifts began to develop and flourish, and that became evident to the Christians. And so you go one more chapter to Acts 14, verse 1, where it says, "At Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went as usual into the Jewish synagogue." Now, did you hear anything different there? The order switched. It says, Paul and Barnabas. Now, from a human standpoint, this is a terrible thing for Barnabas, isn't it? I mean, he has done a lousy job of career management. You want to climb the ladder, right? Not go down the ladder. Apparently, he has not managed things well. Because the mission of the church has been a success. Barnabas should get the credit. He should be the number one guy. So Barnabas easily would have reason, cause to be jealous here. He could have easily longed for Paul's status, which once had been his. But apparently this was not Barnabas's way. Instead, he rejoices in Paul's status because his joy is in seeing other people develop in their gifts and in their capacity. And he's joyful in that, even though it means that Paul's name ultimately will eclipse his own. I mean, who have you heard of more, Paul or Barnabas? Paul. But Barnabas is a true grandstand guy. His life is about more than just himself and what people think of him. His life is about advancing the cause of the kingdom, even if that means he moves from number one to number two and someone else takes his spot. So, how about us? Do we want to be a Barnabas? You know, this week, if you want to, you can be a Barnabas. You can decide this is going to be a Barnabas week for me. I'm going to be God's grandstand guy, or I'm going to be God's grandstand gal. And I'm going to cheer on other people. I'm going to encourage people around me. I'm going to call out the potential that I see in other people. I'm going to be here not just for my good, but for the good of others, for the organization that I'm a part of, for what I see developing in other people. You can choose to begin to be a Barnabas kind of person, whether that means giving a word of affirmation, telling somebody thank you, or just taking the time to listen to somebody who is struggling. As someone once said, encouragement is oxygen to the soul. Without encouragement, our souls wither and our tanks get empty. And so we all need to give and to receive encouragement on a daily basis. It's what it means to be part of Christian fellowship. And that's why Hebrews 3:13 says this: encourage one another once a year. No. It says encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness.